7. No, there, there. She imagined Swift waiting for her on the deck, wearing the tweeds he favored in an L.A. winter, the vest and jacket mismatched, herringbone and houndstooth, but everything woven from the same wool, and that, probably, from the same sheep on the same hillside, the whole look orchestrated in London, by committee, in a room above a Floral Street shop he'd never seen. They did striped shirts for him, brought the cotton from Charvet in Paris. They made his ties, had the silk woven in Osaka, the SenseNet logo embroidered tight and small. And still, somehow, he looked as though his mother had dressed him. The deck was empty. The Dornier hovered, then darted away to its nest. Maman Brigitte's presence still clung to her. She went into the white kitchen and scrubbed drying blood from her face and hands. When she stepped into the living room, she felt as though she were seeing it for the first time. The bleached floor, the gilt frames and cut velvet upholstery of the Louis XVI chairs, the cubist backdrop of a Valmir. Like Hilton's wardrobe, she thought, contrived by talented strangers. Her boots tracked damp sand across the pale floor as she went to the stairwell. Kelly Hickman, her wardrobe man, had been to the house while she'd been in the clinic. He'd arranged her working luggage in the master bedroom. 9 Hermes rifle cases, plain and rectangular, like coffins of burnished saddle hide. Her clothes were never folded. They lay each garment flat, between sheets of silk tissue. She stood in the doorway, staring at the empty bed, the 9 leather coffins. She went into the bathroom, glass block and white mosaic tile, locking the door behind her. She opened one cabinet, then another, ignoring neat rows of unopened toiletries, patent medicines, cosmetics. She found the charger in the third cabinet, beside a bubble card of Derm's. She bent close, peering at the gray plastic, the Japanese logo, afraid to touch it. The charger looked new, unused. She was almost certain that she hadn't bought it, hadn't left it here. She took the drug from her jacket pocket and examined it, turning it over and over, watching the measured doses of violet dust tumble in their sealed compartments. She saw herself place the packet on the white marble ledge, position the charger above it, remove a Derm from its bubble and insert it. She saw the red flash of a diode when the charger had drawn off a dose. She saw herself remove the Derm, balancing it like a white plastic leech on the tip of her index finger, its moist inner surface glittering with minute beads of DMSO. She turned, took 3 steps to the toilet, and dropped the unopened packet into the bowl. It floated there like a toy raft, the drug still perfectly dry. Perfectly. Her hand shaking, she found a stainless nail file and knelt on the white tile. She had to close her eyes when she held the packet and drove the tip of the file against the seam, twisting. The file clattered on tile as she touched the flush button, and the 2 halves of the empty packet vanished. She rested her forehead against cool enamel, then forced herself to get up, go to the sink, and carefully wash her hands. Because she wanted, now she really knew, she wanted to lick her fingers. Later that day, in a gray afternoon, she found a corrugated plastic shipping canister in the garage, carried it up to the bedroom, and began to pack Bobby's remaining things. There wasn't much, a pair of leather jeans he hadn't liked, some shirts he'd either discarded or forgotten, and in the teak bureau's bottom drawer, a cyberspace deck. It was an Ono Sendai, hardly more than a toy. It lay amid a tangle of black leads, a cheap set of Stimtrodes, a greasy-looking plastic tube of saline paste. She remembered the deck he'd used, the one he'd taken with him, a gray factory custom Hosaka with unmarked keys. It was a cowboy's deck. He'd insisted on traveling with it, even though it caused problems during customs checks. Why, she wondered, had he bought the Ono Sendai? And why had he abandoned it? She was seated on the edge of the bed. She lifted the deck from the drawer and put it on her lap. Her father, long ago in Arizona, had cautioned her against jacking in. You don't need it, he'd said. And she hadn't. because she'd dreamed cyberspace, as though the neon grid lines of the Matrix waited for her behind her eyelids. There's no there, there. They taught that to children, explaining cyberspace. She remembered a smiling tutor's lecture in the Arcology's executive creche, images shifting on a screen. Pilots in enormous helmets and clumsy-looking gloves, the neuroelectronically primitive virtual world technology linking them more effectively with their planes. Pairs of miniature video terminals pumping them a computer-generated flood of combat data, the vibro-tactile feedback gloves providing a touch world of studs and triggers. As the technology evolved, the helmets shrank, the video terminals atrophied. She leaned forward and picked up the trode set, shook it to free its leads from the tangle. No there, there. She spread the elastic headband and settled the trodes across her temples, one of the world's characteristic human gestures, but one she seldom performed. She tapped the Ono Sendai's battery test stud, green for go. She touched the power stud, and the bedroom vanished behind a colorless wall of sensory static. Her head filled with a torrent of white sound. Her fingers found a random second stud, and she was catapulted through the static wall into cluttered vastness, the notional void of cyberspace, the bright grid of the Matrix ranged around her like an infinite cage. "Angela," the house said, its voice quiet but compelling, "I have a call from Hilton Swift." "Executive override?" She was eating baked beans and toast at the kitchen counter. "No," it said confidingly. "Change your tone," she said, around a mouthful of beans. "Something with an edge of anxiety." "Mr. Swift is waiting," the house said nervously. "Better," she said, carrying bowl and plate to the washer. "But I want something closer to genuine hysteria." "Will you take the call?" The voice was choked with tension. "No," she said, "but keep your voice that way. I like it." She walked into the living room, counting under her breath. 12, 13. "Angela," the house said gently, "I have a call from Hilton Swift." "On executive override," Swift said. She made a farting sound with her lips. "You know I respect your need to be alone, but I worry about you."
"I'm fine, Hilton. You needn't worry. Bye-bye."
"You stumbled this morning on the beach. You seemed disoriented. Your nose began to bleed."
"I had a nosebleed."
"We want you to have another physical."
"Great."
"You accessed the Matrix today, Angie. We logged you in the Bama Industrial Sector."
"Is that what it was?"
"Do you want to talk about it?"
"There isn't anything to talk about. I was just screwing around. You want to know, though. I was packing some crap Bobby left here. You'd have approved, Hilton. I found a deck of his, and I tried it. I punched a key, sat there looking around, jacked out."
"I'm sorry, Angie."
"For what?"
"For disturbing you. I'll go now."
"Hilton, do you know where Bobby is?"
"No."
"You telling me Net Security hasn't kept tabs on him?"
"I'm telling you I don't know, Angie. That's the truth."
"Could you find out if you wanted to?"
Another pause. "I don't know. If I could, I'm not sure that I would."
"Thanks. Goodbye, Hilton."
"Goodbye, Angie." She sat on the deck that night, in the dark, watching the fleas dance against floodlit sand, thinking of Brigitte and her warning, of the drug in the jacket and the derm charger in the medicine cabinet, thinking of cyberspace and the sad confinement she'd felt with the Ono Sendai, so far from the freedom of the Loa. Thinking of the others' dreams, of corridors winding in upon themselves, muted tints of ancient carpet. An old man, a head made of jewels, a taut, pale face with eyes that were mirrors, and a beach in the wind and dark. Not this beach. Not Malibu. And somewhere, in a black California morning, some hour before dawn, amid the corridors, the galleries, the faces of dream, fragments of conversation she half recalled, waking to pale fog against the windows of the master bedroom. She prized something free and dragged it back through the wall of sleep. Rolling over, fumbling through a bedside drawer, finding a Porsche pen, a present from an assistant grip, she inscribed her treasure on the glossy back of an Italian fashion magazine, T-A. "Call continuity," she told the house over a third cup of coffee. "Hello, Angie," said continuity. "That orbital sequence we did 2 years ago, the Belgian's yacht." She sipped her cooling coffee. "What was the name of the place he wanted to take me? The one Robin decided was too tacky." "Freeside," the expert system said. "Who's taped there?" "Tally Isham recorded 9 sequences in Freeside." "It wasn't too tacky for her?" "That was 15 years ago. It was fashionable." "Get me those sequences."
"Done."
"Bye."
"Goodbye, Angie." Continuity was writing a book. Robin Lanier had told her about it. She'd asked what it was about. It wasn't like that, he'd said. It looped back into itself and constantly mutated. Continuity was always writing it. She asked why, but Robin had already lost interest. Because continuity was an AI, and AIs did things like that. Her call to continuity cost her a call from Swift.
"Angie, about that physical, haven't you scheduled it yet? I want to get back to work. I called continuity this morning. I'm thinking about an orbital sequence. I'm going over some things Tally did. I may get some ideas."
There was a silence. She wanted to laugh. It was difficult to get a silence out of Swift.
"You're sure, Angie? That's wonderful. But is it really what you want to do?"
"I'm all better, Hilton. I'm just fine. I want to work. Vacation's over. Have Porphyry come out here and do my hair before I have to see anyone."
"You know, Angie," he said, "this makes all of us very happy."
"Call Porphyry. Set up the physical."
"Coup poudre. Who, Hilton? Maybe you?"
He had the resources, she thought, half an hour later, as she paced the fog-bound deck. Her addiction hadn't threatened the net, hadn't affected her output. There were no physical side effects. If there had been, SenseNet would never have allowed her to begin. The drug's designer, she thought. The designer would know, and never tell her, even if she could reach him, which she doubted she could. Suppose, she thought, her hands on the rust of the railing, that he hadn't been the designer, that the molecule had been designed by someone else, to his own ends.
"Your hairdresser," the house said. She went inside.
Porphyry was waiting, swathed in muted jersey, something from the Paris season. His face, as smooth in repose as polished ebony, split into a delighted smirk when he saw her.
"Missy," he scolded, "you look like homemade shit."
She laughed. Porphyry clucked and tutted, came forward to flick his long fingers at Angie's bangs with mock revulsion.
"Missy was a bad girl. Porphyry told you those drugs were nasty."
She looked up at him. He was very tall, and she knew enormously strong. "Like a greyhound on steroids," someone had once said. His depilated skull displayed a symmetry unknown to nature.
"You okay?" he asked, in his other voice. The manic brio shut off as if someone had thrown a switch.
"I'm fine."
"Did it hurt?"
"Yeah, it hurt."
"You know," he said, touching her chin lightly with a fingertip, "nobody could ever see what you got out of that shit. It didn't seem to get you high."
"It wasn't supposed to. It was just like being here, being there, only you didn't have to..."
"Feel it as much?"
"Yes."
He nodded, slowly. "Then that was some bad shit."
"Fuck it," she said. "I'm back."
His smirk returned.
"Let's wash your hair."
"I washed it yesterday."
"What in?
No, don't tell me."
He shooed her toward the stairwell.
In the white-tiled bathroom, he massaged something into her scalp.
"Have you seen Robin lately?"
He sluiced cool water through her hair.
"Mr. Lanier is in London, missy. Mr. Lanier and I aren't currently on speaking terms. Sit up now."
He raised the back of the chair and draped a towel around her neck.
"Why not?"
She felt herself warming to the net gossip that was Porphyry's other specialty.
"Because," the hairdresser said, his tone carefully even as he ran a comb back through her hair, "he had some bad things to say about Angela Mitchell while she was off in Jamaica getting her little head straight."
It wasn't what she'd expected.
"He did?
Didn't he just, missy?" He began to cut her hair, using the scissors that were one of his professional trademarks. He refused to use a laser pencil, claimed never to have touched one.
"Are you joking, Porphyry?"
"No. He wouldn't say those things to me, but Porphyry hears. Porphyry always hears. He left for London the morning after you got here."
"And what was it you heard he'd said?"
"That you're crazy, on shit or off. That you hear voices, that the net psychs know."
"Voices. Who told you that?"
She tried to turn in the chair. "Don't move your head. There." He went back to his work.
"I can't say. Trust me."
There were a number of calls after Porphyry left. Her production crew eager to say hello. "No more calls this afternoon," she told the house. "I'll run the tally sequences upstairs." She found a bottle of Corona at the rear of the fridge and took it to the master bedroom. The stim unit in the teak headboard was equipped with studio-grade trodes that hadn't been there when she'd left for Jamaica. Net technicians periodically upgraded equipment in the house. She had a swig of beer, put the bottle on the bedside table, and lay down with the trodes across her forehead.
"Okay," she said. "Hit me."
Into tally flesh, tally breath.
"How did I ever replace you?" she wondered,
overcome by the former star's physical being.
"Do I give people this same pleasure?"
Tally Angie, looking out across a vine-hung chasm that was also a boulevard, glancing up to the inverse horizon, squares of distant tennis courts, Freeside's sun, an axial thread of brilliance overhead. "Fast forward," she told the house. Into smooth pumping muscle and a blur of concrete, Tally hurling her cycle around a low-grav velodrome.
"Fast forward."
A dining scene, tension of velvet straps across her shoulders, the young man across the table leaning forward to pour more wine.
"Fast forward."
Linen sheets, a hand between her legs, purple twilight through plate glass, sound of running water.
"Reverse, the restaurant."
The red wine gurgling into her glass.
"Little more.
Hold it, there." Tally's eyes had been focused on the boy's tanned wrist, not on the bottle. "I want a graphic of the visual," she said, pulling off the trodes. She sat up and took a swallow of beer, which mingled weirdly with the ghost flavor of Tally's recorded wine. The printer downstairs chimed softly as it completed its task. She forced herself to take the stairs slowly, but when she reached the printer in the kitchen, the image disappointed her.
"Can you clear this up?" she asked the house. "I want to be able to read the label on the bottle."
"Justifying image," the house said, "and rotating target object 8 degrees. The printer hummed softly as the new graphic was extruded. Angie found her treasure before the machine could chime, her dream sigil in brown ink, T-A. They'd had their own vineyards, she thought. Tessier Ashpool, S.A., the typeface regal and spidery.
"Gotcha," she whispered.